Okay, so good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are, to our discourse of today, which we'll start with tea. So we're going to do one aspect of tea ceremony that is an interesting part, I believe, and fun to do. You don't need too much. As I mentioned, you should have 2 cups, some tea, and some hot water near you. And then you have a notebook and a pen. So if you want to have everything ready, and I'm going to show you what I do here so you'll follow me. Go ahead and get all that.
I'm going to go get mine. Okay.
Okay, go ahead. But I'll begin while people are getting their things, is we'll talk a little bit about how the Buddhist philosophy arrived in China. Because it's the arrival of the Buddhist philosophy into China that then from China went to Japan and influenced the practice of drinking tea to such a degree that we know it today. Although there was and still is a Chinese tea ceremony, but it's very different from the Japanese tea ceremony. It's nowhere near as formal. As the teachings and the philosophy of the Buddha started in Northeast India, so to speak, or around Nepal, what's now today Nepal, it then couldn't really go directly into China because that's the Himalaya Mountains, and those were very treacherous to cross way back when. So it actually spread through the Northwest, through the passes of Pakistan, up into the areas of Afghanistan, which at the time was called Gandhara, and was influenced a lot by the cultures there. And then along the Silk Road, it came in from the West, coming first into Xi'an, which was the old empire's capital. That's where the big graves of the Qin Dynasty emperor is with all the soldiers underneath. And from there, it spread out into the north of China and into the middle of China. At the same time, there was a flow of Buddhist philosophy going by sea and along the coast from India into Burma and then into what today is would be Thailand and then into Cambodia, into the Khmer Empire, which was the center of Cambodia and Vietnam, and then moving to the up the coast of Vietnam and reached southern China into the area of what today would be Hong Kong or Canton or Guangzhou province. And these two distinct trends actually manifested very differently. The one in the south manifested, it was much closer to Theravadan, although it did have some elements of Mahayana. The one in the north that came in from the west had much more influence of the Mahayana tradition, which was a tradition of thought and writing and consideration and reinterpretation and new ideas coming from India to the Northwest and then into China from the West. Now, I'm not a Buddhist historian by any means, so if you're really interested, there's tons of material on this. When it reached China, it encountered Taoism, and Taoism is the indigenous belief of the Chinese. And Taoism is a very empirical, a very practical type of spiritual or philosophical practice. And I think, and now this is my own interpretation, I'm not alone in this, but it is my own interpretation, I'll own it, and all the errors I'll take responsibility for. It was influenced to return to a certain essential quality of being present. The Buddhist philosophy talked about later on, actually, they talked about this concept of emptiness around the second century. And Nagarjuna was one of the great scholars in India, actually was one of the proponents of this. But what does that really mean in daily life, emptiness? And so Buddhism, I think, has become very ritualized, very ceremonialized, had many different aspects that have become a little bit perhaps rigid in their belief system. And so when it hit China, it hit Taoism, which is completely go with the flow kind of thing. That's a tremendous oversimplification, but we'll just call it that for now, go with the flow. And being in the moment is being with truth. And so it created a very interesting pressure on the Buddhist practice that to bring it back down to right here, right now. Now, where was it otherwise? Perhaps it had been too ritualized. There was too much of this. It became theistic and going to a new land and different things. So with that, a person who we don't know is real or not, but we assume there was some relevance to a real person called Bodhidharma, who supposedly came to China, I think it's the 5th century or the 6th century AD, and he brought Zen and created, or Chan, the practice of sitting. Now, Zen, which is in Japanese, or Son in Korean, or Chan in Chinese, or Dhyana in Sanskrit, is the word jhana in Pali. And we've all talked about jhana. Jhana is absorption. So it means to sit and go into absorption in a type of meditation. So what was emphasized in the teachings of Bodhidharma and Chan was the sitting, the being present, the simplification of all the practice down to the actual practice of sitting. And the rituals and the ceremony were said to be superfluous. Even sometimes study was said to be superfluous, which is very in the scriptures. And that people studying the scriptures could know a lot intellectually, but if they didn't have the experience of sitting, it didn't mean anything. Okay, so it became very clear, very to the point of almost what the Japanese today perhaps would call complete natural perception of what is. So with this movement, I don't want to spend too much time here in China, it then moved quickly from China into Korea and Japan. And the Buddhism that went to China and Japan was primarily Zen and Pure Land sect. Pure Land sect is a different element. We may talk about that in the future sometime, but as Zen came to Japan, it was taken up with great vigor by the Japanese, and it encountered a very interesting and parallel experience to what happened in China. When Buddhism came to China, it met Taoism, and there was a bit of a conflict there. The conflict wasn't between the practitioners in the mountains, the Taoists, and the Buddhist monks, as much as it was manipulated by the political structure at the time to benefit whoever was in power. So the person in power wanted to suppress somebody else who there were many Buddhist practitioners in that area, they would support Taoism. If the people wanted to suppress the Taoist practitioners, they would support Buddhism. So it became a political issue because it became a religion, so to speak. When it went to Japan, it had the same kind of experience. It met the local indigenous Japanese belief called Shintoism. And Shinto means spirit way, or Shendao in Chinese. So, and Shendao or Shinto is very similar to Taoism, except they had certain other aspects that were very unique to the Japanese and close to Japanese shamanic practices, where, for example, I mentioned last week that they believed there was a spirit in every tree and every rock. And that's why you'll see pictures in Japan often of Japan, or if you go to Japan, you will see images of where they have these paper bracelets around trees or around rocks. And these are to honor the spirit that resides in those places. So nature was a very important aspect. The animist aspect of Japanese Shintoism was very strong. So Shintoism met Buddhism, and again, you had this conflict between who was in power and which area of Japan would dominate the other areas. Buddhism was taken up by some emperors or daimyos, and others were left behind. And so what happened, or some shoguns also when it was the warring period. So in that sense, Buddhism became suddenly very much supported by the governments and very ritualized and very stratified. And the government had certain classifications of monks and what you could be. And inheriting a temple was by family. If your father had this temple, then you became a monk and you inherited the temple. There were other aspects that changed in Japan where monks were allowed to get married and have families and children. And so many aspects of Buddhism went through a Japanization of Buddhism. Similarly, many of the traditional arts that evolved in Japan and developed in Japan were influenced strongly by Buddhism, and particularly by Zen Buddhism. And so you hear tea ceremony always associated with Zen Buddhism. You hear archery always associated with Zen Buddhism. You hear swordsmanship, samurai, always associated with Buddhism. And in some cases, these were genuine associations. In other cases, they were expedient means in order to recruit people into a certain political sphere or a certain support. For example, if someone was needed samurai to defend him and he saw that, you know, the samurai were very interested in Zen, then he would suddenly create this Zen thing. And it kind of, there was interweaving of thought. So today we're going to take a little aspect, just a tiny aspect of tea ceremony and learn to practice it ourselves. It's not the whole tea ceremony by any means. That takes years and years and years to study, and you have to be officially approved. When I lived in Japan, I did study for a year with one tea master, and I loved it. I found it very difficult. There were so many other things that I was doing, but I really enjoyed it. And the quality of what can be done in tea ceremony doesn't need all the surrounding accoutrements, although it's nice. And it has, they, each one of them has a meaning, from the tea house, the way it's built, from the direction it's facing, from the windows, from the scroll, from the flower, from the tea utensils, what the tea is in, how the tea is put in the cup, how the tea is whisked, how the guests enter the tea room. And what was very important and emphasized during tea ceremony was it didn't matter if you were an emperor or if you were a laborer. When you came into the tea room in the tea house, you were all equal. That was very, very important. Everybody left the world outside. Now that was one of the influences of Zen. Suddenly, because we understand from the Buddhist teachings that all these externalities really are not real. They're some kind of game everybody's playing. So when you come to reality, we're all equal. And that was partly what was emphasized during tea ceremony. So it became a contemplative practice. And this is a way we can use tea today. You can use coffee too. You can use any beverage, really. But the process is we want to take the daily experience and turn it into an exercise in, what's that famous word that everybody's using today? Anybody can say?
Mindfulness.
Mindfulness, exactly. Very tired of that word, but it's the word everybody uses. I like the word insight. You know, insight, which is a closer translation of vipassana, to give us insight to what's really happening. So last week, we began the Sutra on Craving, the Mahatanha Sankhya Sutta. And we started to talk about how craving and dependency and conditions and all how they related. We're gonna get to that later today. There's some very interesting things, I think. So what relationship does that have to tea ceremony? Besides, tea is fun. It's a little, we have some activity here. The relationship is that in order to understand the dependency arising process and the origination process, we need to be able to break down time into its segments. And time segments are very quick, they're infinitesimal. And that's why we sit. That's the goal of insight practice. That's the goal of Zen, Chan, Dhyan, Jhana absorption, of Samadhi and Vipassana sitting, to break down time, to rather than see this thing as something flowing, to understand that it's moment by moment by moment by moment. It's not one flow. It's like pearls on a string. I think I used this example before, this metaphor. You keep putting pearls on the string of life and each pearl is a moment. You recall that example? Or for example, if you imagine this is the plane, let's say this is a level of consciousness, each time you're brain pings it or your thoughts ping it, that's when you have a thought. We call that a thought moment in Dharma teaching. And a thought moment is infinitesimal. Something like a nano of a nanosecond. I think somebody tried to calculate it out, but it's not given. And so what happens, we're constantly pinging. Everybody see that? And what happens, we don't ping at the same place because we're pinging like this. So it seems like I am having one continuous flow. But actually what's happening is there are many, many, many infinitesimal thought moments all strung together. So the goal of insight is to start to see the spaces between those moments. And the practice in tea ceremony was to see the space in life and to help us break down our perceptions, our expectations, and our disappointments, so that we just can be precisely in the moment, okay? And when we can be in the moment, we start to understand the arising and condition and dependency. Make sense? At least intellectually, because you haven't experienced that yet. That is where tea ceremony, and that's a very, very big oversimplification. So if you're truly interested, what I'd encourage you to do is to look up Terry's tea ceremony, and there's an excellent book called Cha Do. So are we ready to begin? Okay, so you can become very formal with this, but I'm not going to be formal with this. And it's a lovely thing to get all the tea accessories, which I'm not going to go over here because we're not having a tea class. I'm not a formal tea teacher. But what we're going to do is I'm going to show you how to take the tea and drinking daily tea and make it a practice in insight. Okay? Does everybody have the boiling water near them? They have warm water, everybody has the tea, they have two cups, tea bag, two cups, whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So you're not going to see me because I'm going to pull this whole screen down so you can just see what's in front of me. Okay? But I'll be able to see you. So as you see that, there we see the tea. Okay. We have first our tea, right? This can be any kind of tea you want, or it can be a tea bag. Then we have our two cups, which will be these cups. And if you are just using two mugs, these two things are in the same cup because this is the brewing vessel. So what I would encourage you to do when you drink tea is to have a separate vessel for brewing, okay? In general, that's good. So take your tea, wherever that is, and put it into whatever you're going to brew the tea in. It can be a tea mug. It doesn't have to be a separate cup. And then take your water and pour your water into your brewing vessel. There you go. And then you're going to let your tea brew. Okay? So I'm going to cover that and let it brew. Generally, every tea has their own instructions. And today, if you go to any good tea shop, they sell all the tea, brew it at 80 degrees with 2 minutes or 90 degrees at 5 minutes. I would say use those as a guideline. Because even in the finest tea shops, I've noticed that when people talk about tea and how to brew it, it's not always the same. For example, we have a very good tea shop here, very lovely friends of ours, actually, and I love their tea. But if I follow her instructions to brew her Japanese green tea, to me, it tastes bitter. So I brew it faster and a little hotter than she actually recommends. And then I like it. Japan, Taiwan, Korea have kind of taken on the Japanese influence because Korea and Taiwan were both conquered and ruled by Japan, of where tea is a ceremonial type of drink. The Chinese tea ceremony is you put the tea leaves in a cup, a very small cup, something like this size, fully, you pack it, not like I have, but really pack it. You put water, pour it into tiny little cups and drink it. It's like a shot, a tea shot. And they do that with oolong, they do that with green tea, they do it with black tea, and each tea is a shot. So after 5 or 6 shots, you can really be flying. That's the traditional Chinese way. You can see all this on the internet. Okay, so after the tea has had a chance to brew, we'll give it a little bit more. What we're going to do is we're going to pour the tea into, if you have two mugs, you're going to pour the tea from one mug where it's brewing into the other mug, okay? So if you need to put a towel there or something in case there's no mess, make sure you have a towel there if it's not made for pouring, okay? Then once you pour it into the other mug, you're going to take the mug where the tea was brewed. You may still have the tea leaves in it or the tea bag. And what you're going to do is you're going to close your eyes and you're going to put your nose into the cup and you're going to inhale the fragrance of the tea, either the cup or the tea leaves without the tea that's in it, right? And as you close your eyes and you inhale that tea, I want you to think and feel in your body, whatever it is, imagine, whatever you want to describe it, what kind of sensation comes. Now, what comes to your mind? It could be a place. You could say forest or rain or ocean, or you could even say mother or father, or you could say anger or love. Whatever comes to your mind, write it down on the piece of paper and the pen, with the pen that you have next to you, okay? Clear? This is actually a very traditional, we're doing it a little bit modern way, but it is traditional, I'll explain. So we take our brewed tea and I'm pouring it first into this glass, okay? And once I'm done with this glass, moving this, you can see this still, I'm going to pour it into my drinking cup. And then I'm going to take the cup that the tea was in, and if it's, you have two mugs, it's the cup that I'm going to put my nose like this. And I'm going to reflect. What image? What mind? Like, the image came to me was charcoal. Okay. Second thing came to me was elasticity. Now I'm having images of leaves, of wet leaves, of fall, of rain. Just write down 4 or 5 images, that's fine. And when you're done, you can put that cup down.